Welcome to Email After Hours by Senderscore, powered by Validity.
We're your hosts. My name is Guy Hansen.
And I'm Danielle Gallant, and this is Email After Hours.
As any stressed out email marketer could tell you, it takes a village to deploy a great email campaign, much less deploying great email campaigns multiple times a week. And one of the most valuable members in any sender's email tribe is their email service provider, or their ESP. But when issues arise or metrics don't add up, this cozy relationship can feel more like a game of hot potato as the two toss tasks back and forth. And often the question arises, who takes ownership of any given email problem? To save you from future performance hiccups, not to mention some awkward email exchanges or Zoom calls with your ESP, let's try to provide some clarity on who does what on today's episode. We're going to dive deep into the dynamics of this relationship and define really whose hot potato it is. And spoiler alert, sometimes it's neither the ESP or the marketer's job. Sometimes it's a third party, cough, cough. Validity. Understanding everyone's role is mission critical, especially in the months leading up to the holidays when your email marketing challenges will take center stage.
So joining us today, we've got another very special guest in the form of Tom Corbett, who is now a seasoned pro in the world of email marketing since joining it way back in 2008. And Tom and I have known each other for a large part of that time since. We've definitely sunk a few beers together over the years, although now that Tom's LA-based, I think he gets a load more sunshine than I do. But then again, he's got young kids in his life, so maybe I'll get more sleep than he does. Anyways, so he's operated in both B2C and B2B across a wide range of industry sectors. And we're going to be tapping into his wealth of experience today, especially his most recent expertise in deliverability and best practices, directly from his current role as a deliverability consultant at Validity Partner Itrible. Tom, it's so great to have you with us today. Welcome to Email After Hours.
Well, thank you, Guy and Daniel, for having me. I think you were too nice for that intro about myself.
We have to be. You're a nice guy. I'm delighted to have you with us.
I was going to say, we'll put you in the hot seat soon.
There we go.
And on that note, I said in the intro, there can be a bit of a hot potato dynamic between ESPs and the senders. And as someone who works with both, right, through client relationships, I see that sometimes this happens when something has gone wrong, when there is a hiccup in the campaign process, especially when that pertains to a deliverability issue. So where do you think this mindset comes from, where it maybe can be pitting one against the other? And what are some areas in particular where this tension can become apparent?
Yeah, I think definitely kind of going back, you know, Guy mentioned it's kind of seasoned, but like I know I was very naive when I started off in email, you know, frontline support when this situation like this happened. I just wanted to help people, like you're new to this role, customer with the challenge, they may be frazzled on the phone. The first thing you want to do is just fix it. Just like my job is to make a customer happy. And maybe, you know, I think part of that sets an expectation that an ESP will then just do it all for you. As I've developed in my career and learned more about things, I realize that some of those responsibilities, you know, can't be processed by the ESP, especially when it comes around to data acquisition, validation of resources, especially more so in the UK, right? We've had some experience with GDPR when that rolled out and customers asking a lot of questions. That's something that we can't control to a point. We can definitely provide expertise and insights, but we don't have the ability to edit someone's CRM system. But again, that comes down to there's so many providers and vendors out there who've set different expectations. Some are in that startup phase, so they will take on a lot more responsibilities. There are seasoned, you know, veteran platform pros out there who've been, you know, it's their bread and butter, and they have their processes locked down. They are very aware of what they can and can't do. And again, the other bit is like marketers are new. Some people are graduating straight out of college, first marketing job. They don't have a clue. I definitely think I'm guilty sometimes of just forgetting that people don't know what deliverability is. Some people I don't think really care. I probably could send them to sleep, like my daughter at bedtime. I'm like, hang on, this bedtime story isn't working. I'll just tell you about my job. I'll send you to sleep.
Oh, man. You remind me of a story. I'm going to sort of deviate from the planned conversation for a second, but you mentioned GDPR, Tom, and when it happened, there was a guy here in the UK who makes a living out of producing and recording audiobooks, and he'll often pick up like contemporary themes. And his specialization is sort of books that help people to fall to sleep. And he recorded an audiobook about GDPR to help people fall asleep, and it's actually one of his biggest sellers. I kid you not. Anyway, back to today's conversation. So, yeah, Tom, you...
Well, I kind of want to add it to that. You know, we talk about the hot potatoes. When people can't do things, there's a very big US brand. I remember being in the UK working with them. And because they didn't know what to do in regards to who is in the UK or who's in Europe, they just basically blocked any IP coming from Europe to their website. And I know my mum to this day still tells me that she still can't access their website or purchase anything from there. So she's like, can you just order this for me online? And when I come out, I'll come and pick up the items. So it's like, it's interesting this that there are some perhaps limitations, maybe from a technical standpoint or a legal standpoint. And, you know, it rather than take the financial risk, or it's easy just to kind of restrict that kind of access.
It's a real thing. I wanted to sign up with one of our US customers' email programs last week, and it flatly wouldn't let me. Anyway, we digress. You've already looked at a couple of misconceptions, but do you think there's like a single biggest misconception from your customer side in terms of something that they think the responsibility sits with you as the ESP, whereas actually it sits firmly with them?
I think the biggest one is, you know, we know that block lists are out there, right? You know, mistakes happen. But when a more serious one does occur, the expectation is, hey, you can speak to, and I joke, Mr. Google, Mr. Microsoft, you can call them on your, you know, bat phone and just fix it. Not kind of understanding that maybe there's an underlying issue with regards to why it happened, but you'll just fix it. And then there's that expectation of every time it happens, you'll just fix it and fix it. Bit like, right, you know, we as kids, right, we trip and fall and we get up and, you know, scrape, but we're not stopping ourselves from it happening again, yeah. Right? And it's like, what preventative action could be taken? And it's very difficult, I think, to have those conversations, like honest, genuine conversations around, you know, it's not about the blame game, but just kind of self-reflecting and looking back on, okay, well, what did we do that could have caused that change or that impact? And of course, there are situations of honest mistakes, right? We've seen it. We've definitely seen accidental listings where, you know, back-end processes have changed, but it's, I think we're all guilty, right? Pointing finger. You know, we've senders, receivers, it's just easy to, it's not my fault, not my fault. And I've made marketing mistakes, you know, back in my early days, and I'll put my hand up. Like, I've definitely done it and be as transparent, but it's better to just be that way about things because you're going to have more trust and respect at the end of the day.
And this whole concept must have almost certainly led to one or two flashpoints over the years, you know, where your customer's pointing their finger going, hey, you were supposed to do it and you didn't. What's the wackiest complaint you've ever had from a customer in that kind of way?
Not me directly. However, a colleague of mine worked with a hotel chain based out in the US, and they threatened to sue Microsoft. They got completely blocked and like, we're losing this much revenue, millions of dollars in revenue, and they threatened to sue them. We were like, we are probably advised not to do that. But that was the wildest thing I've ever come across. I've had, you know, people saying, get on the phone, give me the phone number for people, but it wasn't my fault. But yeah, that's the wackiest one, like just saying we're going to sue a mailbox provider.
I know it's not the same client or the same brand because it was not a hotel chain. Tom, I also had someone who wanted to sue Microsoft specifically because of SRD, junk votes. And for anybody who doesn't know, that's sender reputation data. These are like not quite spam complaints, but it is a spam vote, essentially. That's a Microsoft program. They were like, this is not legal. Like, we're going to get to the bottom of this. And I was like, I do not recommend doing that. I think that's so crazy. I'm glad we both have this same wacky Microsoft story. Now, actually, on that note, too, ESPs and senders do have pretty distinct responsibilities. You've touched on a couple of these. So generally, for ESPs, there are like technical to-dos, right? So making sure the infrastructure for an IP or domain is sound, authentication, often feedback loop application, stuff like that. And then on the sender side, they're maintaining customer relationships. So it's their decision about, you know, frequency, personalization, as you said, maintaining their CRM and making sure that is healthy and clean. But in very broad strokes, and for a newbie, maybe one of those fresh out of college marketers, how would you differentiate the sender's responsibilities from the ESP's?
Oh, that's a really good question. I've always thought about like how to explain this, because there's so many nuances and things to make this email sending to work. I think I've always thought about it like, think of your ESP as almost like a doctor and you're going for a health check. You know, you are the patient. You come in and your doctor's going to review you, tell you like your blood pressure's this, whatever metrics they are. They're going to provide you recommendations, right? Like, here's what we can do now and here's what we can do to fix that. However, some of those tasks are going to be on the sender. So like, if you need to change your diet, the doctor physically cannot force feed you to eat. You need to change that diet. Kind of like putting that to more, I guess, into our industry, is that, you know, technical configuration, right, is most likely, you know, we're responsible for kind of getting your foundations in your house in place. So, you know, making sure your domains records have got correctly configured, providing those recommendations of, okay, let's not go basic authentication. Let's get up to DMARC. Let's get to BIMI. Put yourself in the best standing kind of to start sending. Whereas the sender, it's about, you know, ensuring they are sending to people who actually want their email. So who has purchased? You have all that behavioral data and that profile data on the individual. So really building those kind of one-to-one messages that are relevant and timely. That's information and visibility that I don't have insight unless you share it with me.
Right.
Now, there are times of the year where this dynamic becomes even more important. You know, we're about to head into the Q4 sales season madness. So how do you go about prepping your customers specifically for that? Educating them that, you know, now is the time that you need to start ramping up early, not doubling your volume about 3 days before Black Friday. And in your mind, what's the role that ESP should be playing here to ensure smooth execution as we move into that peak sales season?
Yeah, I think it's about having honest conversations, in honesty. Like, I've been talking to customers as early as June. It sounds crazy to think about, hey, we're going to talk about October and November now. And it's more because, you know, life happens, right? Everyone's busy. People are giving more and more responsibility, so they don't have the time. But, you know, there's pressure from above, right? You have sales targets to hit. And then we mentioned volumes are requested to double. So kind of getting customers to do the audit of their infrastructure, right? You know, do they need to change authentication records? Do they need to kind of do that annual check of, right? Do they need to do any key rotation? Have they made any changes? Or don't change ESP probably the week of, you know, Black Friday. Don't do IP warming that week, probably a good one. But I've got some customers who kind of do like regular data validation and auditing of customers. You're using tools like, you know, your validity zone and validation tools, etc. But actually sharing their content calendar, giving us visibility of like, hey, what are you planning to send? Is it regards to, you know, volume? Is it kind of cadence? Just so we can actually educate on like, okay, well, as a recipient, would we want to receive this and put yourself in those individual shoes? I have noticed, though, a lot more, you know, terms and conditions emails this year recently, which I know we've talked about the question of increasing volume as like, I feel like some senders are using that as a soft way of like who's actually still active. That's just my opinion based on some of the emails I've received. Like, why am I getting this terms and condition email mid-August? I'm like, oh, hang on. Is it probably because they want to stop doing that cleanup? I'm like, which is fine. Like, I get it. Smart move to do. But it was just an unusual approach I'd not seen before.
That is a perfect transition into what I wanted to ask next in terms of major industry changes or updates that are happening right now. So one of them, of course, is Gmail's new inactive policy. And so for people who are unfamiliar with this, Google announced that starting in December, it was going to be essentially shutting down email addresses that had not been logged into for 2 years or more. And they're doing this, of course, December. It's better maybe than November, but lots of senders are reaching further and further back into their lists around this time to cast a really wide net for the holiday season. So I do have senders that are actually kind of doing what you described, Tom, which is like, let's send an email that tests out these Gmail subscribers specifically or whatever. ahead of time. But there's the Gmail change. There's Apple in September coming out with their new operating system, iOS 17, that has link tracking protection that people are kind of worried about. So apart from the regular holiday, you know, woes or don't warm up your IP 2 weeks before this, what kind of deliverability advice are you doling out? Is it related to these industry, like broader industry updates, or is it mostly just we're going to do this health check? What's your usual
spiel? So we definitely, anytime we're made aware of the Gmail retiring address, we're very transparent with customers, just kind of educate them, like, here's changes that are coming. Here's a way we can kind of get ahead of the game. We talk about Wand of Mail, like, if we are supposedly segmenting, sending to customers that only want mail, we should be able to remove this, right? So there's going to be customers who aren't going to be impacted whatsoever. However, there's others who maybe aren't aware, maybe then, they are kind of beginning their journey with regards to email as a channel. They're not familiar with what a soft bounce is and what like a mailbox full error is and how to, kind of cut their list to remove those individuals. There's just kind of education on that side of things. It does seem wild that, Gmail going for a 2-year window. You'd think, historically we've always assumed it's like 12 months like inactivity, but good for them to give people kind of, a bit of breathing space. Not that I'm suggesting 2 years is now the window for when you should be sending to active customers.
Well, I was going to say there are ingenious ways that the mailbox providers are maybe trying to push the envelope forward. And we see this sometimes with senders too, but maybe not in the best way. Have you ever seen or have any interesting stories about shortcuts that senders have tried to take when it comes to maybe gaming the system or a quick fix that maybe doesn't really exist? I'm interested how that shook out.
Back in the day, right, the classic quick fix was just a solid JPEG image, right? They just didn't want to code. So it was just flat file, right? So like just one huge image. Just, I've worked at a few different ESPs now, but the editors available, you could just, it's templated, right, to a point. So it's just a table. They uploaded the image, put an unsubscribe link in, send. Because they didn't have time. They didn't have the skills to generate HTML email and like structure it in the right manner. So that's been, back in the day, before drag and drop became a thing. More recently, I'm trying to think if there's been any shortcut, really. I haven't come across anything wild, in all honesty. I think, I wouldn't say it's cutting corners a rush, but I think it's just about accessibility. I think that's where corners are cut these days, is, we have dark mode on devices, so they cater for just general, and they don't use an image preview or test, and they just, why is my email look ghastly in said mailbox provider? That's one. But they're not accommodating people colorblind or reading. No, that's the key piece, right? You're missing, and that's, and then it shows you're not really actually building relationships with your recipients. I think that's where I feel like people are rushing, is just not building that trust and that kind of two-way relationship with customers to go and really understand them.
Yeah, I think there's so much good advice there. Now, I want to revisit sort of a point we were sort of making a couple of questions ago, and I think you were hopefully half joking when you said, sort of the run-up to Black Friday is a pretty bad time to change ESP. I mean, you're right. Hopefully you'll be mad enough to jump on. But in your sort of 15 years of experience, do you think there's like a single non-negotiable cast in stone principle for both senders and ESPs to adhere to during that Q4 rush?
Don't just go and find a list out of a drawer. That's always the one. Hey, we've got this data we found. And we joke, right? But we know this pressure, right? And then, and that terminology could be...
We found this data.
And it's like, and sometimes there's honest, CRM mistakes. I know that happens, right? They, the way the segmentation and files cut, it does accidentally exclude a subpopulace of customers. That happens, right? But don't use this as the opportunity. Let's introduce them right this second, and it's going to triple our send volume. You're like, when did that seem like, I understand the opportunity, but, is the risk worth the rewards? And then what are the repercussions from then, the amount of work needs to be done? That's the typical one.
I think that's right.
I know even rebranding, I've had some customers want to completely rebrand. Hey, brand new domains, everything. Right. And that's doesn't happen. I mean, that's a very, very one in a million, but that has happened once. I want to say about 6 years ago. And I was like, can we do this in January? This would be a better time.
But I was going to say, I mean, especially your comment about, you know, don't buy that rogue list. Maybe that's an extreme example, but you're also right. I mean, I've spoken to so many program owners, and this is the time of year where their CRO comes to them and goes, hey, wait a second, don't we have like a million extra addresses? And I know they haven't responded in the last 3 years, but hey, let's send them. Maybe we'll make some more money out of them. And it's a real thing.
I'm going to change gears a little bit to talk about something that has just dominated the conversation, at least for me and for my clients, certainly for Guy, I know that, over the last maybe year, 6 months in particular, and that's AI. I have senders who are actively, or clients who are actively working to integrate or partner with a vendor to get AI up and running in a tight time frame before that holiday season begins. So just a broad question on AI and really automation. How do you envision these technologies influencing the sender ESP dynamic?
Ooh, that's a good question. It's kind of weird to say, because I kind of say, I feel like the mailbox providers have kind of already been doing this for a while. They've already got their own AI-based tools, right? So we're playing catch-up, you know, this new, I wouldn't say trend, right? It's changing the world, but we're playing catch-up to it, right? I know here where I'm at Audible, we've got some, you know, we've got AI capabilities and helping customers understand a bit more about their data. I know there's a lot of different vendors out there doing helping write copy. But yeah, I think it's exciting, but at the same time concerning. And the reason I say concerning, usually old me wouldn't be like, great, this is awesome. It means AI is making my life easier because those generic repetitive questions are just going to, you know, have that as gospel truth and hopefully standardize the response at every provider. Because I know there's always terminology wording changes. But as a parent now, there's a lot more risk of people impersonating. So there could be AI bots out there pretending to be Guy, myself, you know, whoever, visually creating images of us, making fake videos and spreading misinformation. And the reason I say that is I know there's, I think it was a New York Times article about, you know, warning parents about not posting back to school pictures online on Facebook because there are malicious people out there taking the images and making very inappropriate images. But
what?
You know, I would never have thought about that until being a parent. And I was like, wait a minute, I don't post too many pictures of my daughter anyway, just because I've not got permission from her to post online. You know, I'm all about the whole consent for her own consent. But it made me think, well, how could that then be a potential risk to brands? So I think it's exciting to hopefully help with regards to efficiencies, you know, helping maybe make things a little bit, helping with segmentation, selection, actually building one-to-one messages. But then I think there is, you know, it does need regulating with regards to like, well, how do we ensure that brands aren't impersonating? Right. You know, we've talked, spoofing's been a huge thing. You know, we talk about, you know, authentications improving to help prevent it from a, you know, that piece. But what's to stop, you know, AI then impacting brands and, you know, using that in tone and voice so to make it look really like them? So I think it's going to take a while to know where, which direction it goes, and if, are we going to embrace it and it's going to be fully invested in, or are we going to be like, how do we just put some safety rails in place to prevent things from happening?
I think you make such a good point about, you know, AI driven impersonation. And another story I've read about recently where it's a big challenge is for the banks, where they're using voice recognition as part of their authentication protocols for telephone banking, and now it's, you know, easy to clone voices that completely bypass that. Speaking of emerging trends, you touched on this briefly a few minutes ago, but let's talk some more about BIMI, brand indicators for message identification, because I know it's a bit of a pet topic of yours, and you wrote a great blog post about this recently. For our listeners, check out the Audible blog. It's well worth a read. But in the context of today's conversation, Tom, it feels like a lot of senders, you know, they've heard of BIMI, they recognize the value, they want to put it in place, but whose responsibility is it when it comes to getting it set up?
No, I love this question because I think there's always going to be the it depends for this. And, you know, in my mind, having worked in many different ESPs where senders can delegate domains to us, I do feel like it's probably our responsibility to help configure that. You know, we can set up a SPF, a DKIM, a DMARC record on your behalf. So why shouldn't we just do it by default, right? You know, out of the box, you're ready to go. Yes, there are going to be some additional steps from that. It's not as simple as that. You would need to get your logo trademarked. Again, that is the sender's responsibility to do that. So it's basically, I guess, a collaboration to kind of get it to fruition. I think the benefits outweigh the work. We want to ensure that senders are trusted. So the benefit from doing BIM is that you get your logo displayed at some of the biggest mailbox providers in the world. That's straight away brand recognition and trust with your recipients. Great. The probability of spoofing is a lot lower. You're more likely to engage with going, oh, I recognize that logo. I'm going to click it. But you're actually benefiting all the big providers out there. You are helping them with their filtering to go, this is legitimately you. All the other garbage that's been claiming to be you, we know what to do with it. So it's kind of a win-win on both sides, in my opinion. We've seen stats from different postmasters on how much spam they receive. Was it like 80% of daily traffic is just garbage to them? And you think, that's insane. And some of it gets through. So how do we just help them out as well? Especially the expectation is, why is my email not in the inbox? So, what are we doing to help them as well to show we should be there?
I agree with you. I think that it really is a collaboration to get BIMI set up. And it is confusing because there are DNS changes or updates with records, and there's third-party vendors like Entrust or whatever providing a VMC. So it takes a village, as we said at the beginning. And kind of on that note, we've really, of course, as we intended to, talked about sender versus ESPs and that relationship and that ecosystem. But of course, there are third parties. It is not just a sender and an ESP. There are mailbox providers. There are block lists that need to be communicated with. There are companies like Validity. Do you find that interaction with these third parties is essential and also helps smooth out maybe any kinks that come up in the relationship between a sender and their ESP?
There's always going to be a situation where someone doesn't want to hear the information that's being presented to them. Same as us, right? There's times where I don't want to hear that information, but having a group conversation where all three, or four, whoever, many vendors on the phone, but everyone has the same information, it kind of makes it a little bit easier to how do we move forward? How do we work together? Versus when it's just the two, you can feel like a bit of back and forth butting heads. That's not every customer, right? I think it's just, how do we present the data? And just how do we just help each other out here? Because we can do so much work on our end to do changes, right? There are times, we will reach out to as many postmasters as possible. But if we're not seeing the change, we can't do too much because it's they expect you to change this behavior. If you're not willing to do it, it's like a rock and a hard place. We want to help you, but they're telling us directly that you need to change this or else you're going to be stuck in this awkward situation. So when someone like Guy gets on the phone with us, we can present all the data sets. Sometimes you definitely have access to additional information directly from the postmasters that I don't, such as SRD. So having that additional piece of the puzzle is always insightful, useful, and just shows also just how we all collaborate in this space. Yes, there's so many different ESPs out there, but we all have a common goal. We all talk together. We all see each other at industry events. We want this industry to be successful. And like you said, it takes a village. And a lot of these great standards developments have come from people collaborating.
Tom Corbett, this has been such a good conversation today. And I think you've provided us with some great ideas and guidelines, about that occasionally tricky relationship between senders and their ESPs. It's been really great listening. And thanks for that. We're going to have to start wrapping up now. We normally finish up with a couple of quick fire questions. And I think hopefully an easy one for you. You must see a lot of different emails in the course of doing your day job. Is there one brand, one program that you think is doing email really well? And if so, what makes them great?
I feel like I'm the worst person to ask this question because I feel when I'm not working, I'm with my daughter. So I don't really, I have a lot of emails going to my promotional emails, but I barely read them. So for me now, it's about what stands out. So recently, I would say Williams Sonoma stood out to me because I am looking to buy a new coffee machine, but because they're using the annotations function to do the carousel images, it is the one of the few emails that just stood out. I was like, oh, visually great, versus scanning and reading every subject line. That, you know, I don't have the attention span or the time anymore with a three-year-old to be just reading emails on my phone all day. I wish I could. So I think visually, our attention spans of we don't have that time. Right? So that's for me is for them right now is the one top of mind.
And this is less of a question and more of a hot take. And this actually came from, just to be blunt, we were chatting about, you know, this episode and what we wanted to talk about during the episode. You had a really unique opinion on your favorite mail app. A, do you remember this part of the conversation?
I do, yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to regret saying it, right?
Tell us about it. Tell us about it now.
Yeah, so I meant, you know, to go and Daniel, I mentioned that for me right now, I think Yahoo's mail app is my favorite. I know everyone says that we love Google, and I do love using my Gmail app, so don't worry. But I think they've made it a bit easier, in all honesty, with regards to their version of the promo tab. They've got the shopping tab, but it does the annotation style, your preview. You know, you can have a visual preview of images on, which is, I think, is great. But it then reminds us about above the fold, because, you know, it's been what, over 10 years since we talk about above the fold, but it kind of really makes you think about the creative side of things. Like, is my CTA within that window frame? It actually has subcategories to say, okay, I want to go from shopping to just travel, just to fashion. So it's kind of really like is a concierge for your inbox, but also has a deals
wow.
tab. So like I can go straight there and it just shows me every deal that's about to expire, travel, fashion. So I don't really have to find the email because I'm like, oh, where was that coupon? I can just go there, click it, done. So for me, it's just ease of use versus having to code all these things to kind of get to that level.
I would have to say that Marcel at Yahoo would be so, so pleased with your answer. And I think the way you described it, you know, sort of concierge for their inbox, that's exactly what Yahoo's been aiming at with a lot of their recent sort of functionality development. So hopefully you've nailed it. Great answer. We need to wrap up for today. Just very briefly, we will be back again in 2 weeks' time with another longtime friend of Validity. Danielle and myself will be joined by Alice Cornell, and we'll be digging into her experience across her times at ReturnPath, Change.org, most recently as an independent email consultant. We're going to be challenging a couple of commonly held email myths and realities, and it might even include whether email subscriber engagement varies with the phase of the moon. But you're going to have to join again in 2 weeks to find out more about that. Bye for now.
Thanks.
Be sure to tune in next time and hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And don't forget to visit senderscore.com for loads more great resources to help you become a stronger sender.
To all you sleepless senders out there, thank you for joining us after hours, and see you next time.